This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Barack Obama won the Democratic presidential nomination in part because of his stance against the war in Iraq. As president, he inherited not just that conflict, but a war in Afghanistan and the wider fight against al-Qaeda and other groups that his predecessor labeled the War on Terror. Now, 2 years after he took office, it's clear that President Obama's war policies are very similar to those of President Bush, except where he's expanded the fight. He sent thousands of additional troops to Afghanistan, for example, sharply increased drone attacks in Pakistan. He's also approved the assassination of Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen now in Yemen, believed to have been involved in the Fort Hood shootings and the failed Christmas Day bombing of an airliner. In a new book, law professor and novelist Stephen Carter examines the morality of Obama's wars through the lens of the just war theory and argues that his policies conform to those of many American presidents and many American wars. Put simply, he writes, "We fight to win." Is there a difference between the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, between the war policies of George W. Bush and Barack Obama? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, why Keith Olbermann signed off on Friday night. But first, Stephen Carter joins us from a studio at Yale University in New Haven, where he's a professor of law. His new book is The Violence of Peace, America's Wars in the Age of Obama. And it's nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
It's nice to be back. Thank you for having me.
And is there an Obama doctrine?
It's a little too early to say there's an Obama doctrine, but in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech in December 2009, he did lay out a fairly clear and cogent argument for going to war, as he himself said, in the face of evil. At the top of the hour, you played a little bit of that speech where he spoke about evil. The very next couple of lines after that are really the really interesting part, where he went on to say that when evil does exist in the world, sometimes you have no choice but to confront it by force of arms.
Nonviolence, he said, would not have defeated Hitler's armies.
That's what he said. And he tried to limit it. He said he would limit it, from what I could tell of the speech, to self-defense and also to defense of others. That is, what he suggested, which would be a break from what other American presidents have done, is that, for example, in the face of a genocide taking place elsewhere in the world, that it might be appropriate for American forces to go stand between the perpetrators and the victims of the genocide. No American president has ever suggested that quite as clearly as President Obama did in that speech.
Some, in retrospect, did Bill Clinton, but talking about Rwanda. But in any case, not while he was in office. Going back, though, to that speech, that's probably the most carefully thought out and articulated version of his thoughts on war. He cited a gave a list of examples of when it was right for the United States to use force, as you said, self-defense, and link them to the long-standing thoughts about just war that go back to Catholic theologians, back to the 4th century.
I think Obama did us a great service in that speech, and there's an interesting way in which we, the American people, owe him a service in return. One of the things that's often been missing in discussions of war in the United States, to go, not to go, is any sort of deep reflection on the nature of war and the morality of war. Obama clearly, by personality, is a reflective person. People say he's a little bit cerebral. Just war theory, which is a part of Western philosophy and does, as you said, come originally from Catholicism, just war theory provides a framework for thinking about war, and it's clearly one that he finds attractive. In just war thinking, you have to have a just cause to go to war, but war also has to be a last resort, and you have to have a reasonable hope of success. And then when you fight the war, you have to do it in a way that uses the minimum possible force and doesn't target noncombatants and so on. And all of those are ways of thinking not about whether war is legal or illegal, but whether it's right or wrong. And I think by inviting us to think about right and wrong instead of legal or illegal, the president is inviting us into a reflective conversation about war, which I hope we can have without the usual partisan screeching that is part of so many of our debates about policy in the United States.
However, before we leave the issue of legality, a lot of people said, look, the previous president, George W. Bush, went to the United Nations to try to get legal cover for an invasion of Iraq, did not get it, and went anyway, that the war on that basis was illegal.
Yeah, I don't think – I don't agree with those international lawyers who believe that a war has to be approved by the United Nations to be legal. So I'm not sure whether the war in Iraq was illegal. But I do think that as a moral matter, it was a war that was very difficult to justify. Even if you accepted all the Bush administration's premises about the presence of weapons of mass destruction and so on, that still doesn't tell you whether your own country is in serious and imminent danger or not. And absent that, it's difficult in just war thinking to justify that war. President Obama, in his speech, largely ignored the Iraq war, but he described the war in Afghanistan as a war of self-defense. He's also elsewhere called the war that must be won and a war of necessity. And my main quarrel with the president on those points, with President Obama on those points, is that if he thinks it's a war that must be won, he owes us, I think, a somewhat clearer definition of what would constitute winning it and how we'll know whether we've won or not.
Both things that are quite murky in a situation. Well, you have unreliable partners. It's a little unclear as to how many of the Taliban you might bring over to one side or the other, what situation you might leave in.
No, I think that's right. And part of the problem is that when people look at the war in Afghanistan, when you look at when the war was popular back in October and November of 2001, it was envisioned then as a war in self-defense, or you could say even sliding over a little bit over it to a kind of vengeance. The notion was these people came and got us. We're going to go and make sure they can't do that again. All right, but now that was 9 years ago. And we're still there. And are we fighting the same people? Are we fighting different people? Although the president insists on the importance of winning this war, I don't think he's given us a clear explanation of what winning would be. My hope is that tomorrow in his State of the Union message, he might actually answer that.
And you also point out that, at least you argue, that Afghanistan, in the sense of, yes, we were attacked from forces based in Afghanistan, the purpose of the war was to prevent another attack, at least 9 years ago. The purpose of the war in Iraq was to prevent an attack. The idea of those wars, despite their provocation, was different, but the idea of those wars was the same.
I think the idea is very similar. And even today, if you look at the most recent White House report, the declassified part of it about the Afghan war that came out in December, what the White House talks about as progress in the war means keeping the Taliban out of power. Now, that's described in the report as though that's obviously part of the self-defense of the United States. Maybe it is, but that seems to me a sufficiently difficult issue that it's one worth talking about. That is, whether keeping the Taliban out of power is sufficiently closely related to self-defense of the United States that we ought to be spending lives and resources and also killing in order to accomplish it.
We're talking with Stephen Carter, author most recently of The Violence of Peace, America's Wars in the Age of Obama. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. What is the morality behind America's wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and elsewhere as it pursues al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations? And let's go first to David. David with us from St. Paul.
Neil and Dr. Carter, it's great to hear from you. I had a discussion with your screener, but I think that now that you mentioned the war aim of keeping the Taliban out of power, that's a fairly comprehensive concept, and it raises the question where. Clearly, we don't want the Taliban in power in Afghanistan, but we also seem to have, we actually have a very serious interest in not having them come to power in Pakistan, a nuclear-armed country as well. In fact, I would argue that that may be the more important aim in our situation in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I also would say that, you know, the premise, that your introductory premise of Mr. Obama's and Mr. Bush's policies being very similar to the same as far as war policies. You know, war policy, again, as Mr. Carter pointed out, has to do in many cases, or hopefully in most cases in the first instance, as to why you go to war in the first place. And I think that there, you know, based on your discussion of just war theory, they are very different in some ways. I mean, clearly, Mr. Obama objects to why we went to Iraq, into Iraq in the first place. He doesn't have a problem at all with why you went into Afghanistan. I will also suggest that from a budgetary and a standpoint of governance, you know, the idea that we would go to war in either place without raising taxes and making the American people pay for the war, also without conserving strategic resources, especially in the case of Iraq. And then, of course, without exposing the able-bodied male and now female section of the U.S. population for the eventuality or possibility of participation in combat by reactivating, in a full sense, the selective service system. That all also goes into one's attitudes about how one fights a war once one has started and whether one starts one in the first place.
But, Stephen Carter, does it go to morality?
Well, there were a lot of really good points in David's question. I'm going to stick to two of them, and maybe these are the two easy ones. I don't know. First, on the last point, it is true, I think, that neither President Bush nor President Obama, in prosecuting these wars, has said to the American people, these wars are so important that you need to sacrifice for them. So when we think of sacrifice, we think of getting extra screening at the airport, and we argue over that. But the caller, in talking about taxes or the draft or things like that, is pointing to the way war used to be understood in the United States, what used to be called total war. The notion was the nation, if it's going to be a long and difficult war, commits itself in ways that are sacrificial, and the shared sacrifice helps force the government to have to justify the war. Now, the Pentagon says it doesn't, doesn't need the draft, and both administrations have said they don't need to raise taxes to pay for the wars. I'm not going to go into whether they need to or not. I do agree with the premise that the sacrifice issue is important, especially in a long and difficult war. But on the other part I wanted to mention, though, the caller pointed out that the problem isn't just the Taliban in Afghanistan. There's a broad range of problems. And although
This will not be a short thought, so I'm going to hold you right there, and we'll get to it after a short break. David, stay with us on the line. We'll put you on hold, and we'll get back to that, because one of the premises of Stephen Carter's book is, if you look at President Obama's words and deeds over the past 2 years about his war policies, it will give you an insight into what he may do or may have to do if there is another situation that may, well, require thought about American intervention. So Pakistan, that's a place to think about it. Stay with us. I'm Neil Cunningham. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The man who many considered the peace candidate is in the last election was transformed into a war president. Thus writes Yale Law professor Stephen Carter in his new book, The Violence of Peace, America's Wars in the Age of Obama. Americans often assume their commanders-in-chief have vast decision-making power. When it comes to national security, Stephen Carter argues presidents are often forced to pick from a very few unappealing options. You can read more about why very different presidents can see the world in similar ways in an excerpt at our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Stephen Carter is still with us. We want to hear from you. Is there a difference between the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? How do you look at war policy through the lens of morality? 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at that forum mentioned website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Our caller Jeff is still with us, and our caller David is still with us from St. Paul. And Stephen Carter, you were about to address his question about, it's not just a question of keeping the Taliban out of power in Afghanistan, but perhaps in Pakistan, a nuclear-armed country as well.
Well, yes, and I actually am going to be very brief. I think that what David has asked about is exactly what Obama has realized, that although the war on terror, as it's often called, not a phrase Obama likes to use, but nevertheless, the war on terror was one of the most controversial parts of the so-called Bush Doctrine, that Obama, once in office, seems to not only to have endorsed it, but to have widened it. He seems to have a very broad sense of the places in the world where America faces threats. He's authorized special forces in countries where his predecessor didn't use them. He's using many more drone attacks. In his eulogy for the seven CIA officers who were killed in Afghanistan, President Obama said that the job of the intelligence community is to eliminate our enemies. And in the context of the speech, it's clear he meant eliminate them before they can attack us. So although it's self-defense in a sense, what's really striking about this broader war is the notion is you try to get good enough intelligence that you know who you think is going to attack you, and then you get them first.
David, thanks very much for the call. Let's see if we go next to this is Christopher with us from Mill Valley in California.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good, good. I just had a quick point to make and then a question or to piggyback on what Mr. Carter is saying. It seems to me that asking the question whether or not the United States or when, at what point do we define winning the war, you know, when does Obama lay that out, it seems to me that, and I can use the war in quotes because it's kind of happening in a lot of different places, it seems, at this point. It seems to me that really what's in the best interest of the United States, as President Obama pointed out in his speech, the Nobel Peace Prize speech, is that if we can manage to keep our quote-unquote enemies off guard or destabilized or pitted against each other, in some sense we do win, or we do create instability so that no particular group or something, or, you know, rises up. Now, I realize that's it's a long-term projection, and it's also up to a lot of debate, because people, you know, a lot of people feel, and myself included, that if you allow forces of good to rise up and children get educations these places in the world where people are, you know, desperately poor and constant war for hundreds if not thousands of years, they can make a better life. In the case of the president, it seems to me that he has the interests of the United States at heart, and must be a very difficult balancing act. And I'm glad that, thank you, Mr. Carter, for writing about these kinds of things and bringing it to our attention, because I'm no scholar, but, you know, books like this help me see a broader picture. So that was the point I wanted to make.
All right. Stephen Carter?
I should say that part of what led to my writing this book, and actually put other projects aside to work on it, was this really striking sense that in Obama we had a man who had clearly, most of his supporters believed this is the man who's going to make peace around the world. And clearly a lot of those who were against him thought he's going to somehow run down the American military or something. And neither side turned out to be right. That is, once in office, faced with a menu of actual threats around the world, he behaved in a way like a lot of American presidents, a combination of pragmatism and ferocity. The pragmatism of believing there are actual threats that have to be stopped, and then the ferocity of stopping them often with enormous force. And so if you think about the use of drone missiles, for example, and President Obama has used them now at more than twice the rate that his predecessor did, they don't always make the evening news, but they do often miss their targets. Or if they hit their targets, they take out a lot of other people too. That's a ferocious tool, you might say, for trying to get people you think have attacked us or are about to attack us, and one I think we should have more debate about.
And one that, and thanks very much for the call, Christopher, emphasizes something you emphasized in the book, the quality of intelligence. Obviously, this is important. If the only way to strike at the leadership of the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Pakistan is through drone attacks, well, they're an important tool. Nevertheless, the good intelligence is proper to hit a meeting of leaders as opposed to a wedding party.
And we have hit far too many wedding parties. But of course, it's that need for good intelligence that led to the temptation in the Bush administration to torture some suspects. And I think that came out of a sense of frantic fear. What are these people going to do next, and how are we going to get that information out of them? It was a terrible episode in our history, and I hope we don't repeat it. But at the same time, there is a real question here that the point of the war against terror, which Obama is continuing to fight, is to prevent the United States from being struck by people who are going to blow up buildings and planes and so on. You have to get good intelligence to do that. And the challenge of how you get good intelligence has been an immense one. We've gotten a lot of good intelligence, I gather, over the last few years. There haven't been the kind of very serious attacks here that we've seen in some places in Europe and, of course, today in Moscow. But nevertheless, I think it's a continuing challenge how to defend their values so you don't use certain kinds of methods that we should stay away from, but at the same time get the information we need to prevent these attacks from taking place.
Let's go next to Giles. Giles with us from Denver.
Yes. I take as my authority for what I'm about to ask conversations I had with two constitutional law professors, one from Harvard, the other from the University of Colorado at Boulder, after they were interviewed on National Public Radio. My question is the following. I have nowhere heard anyone go to the point of addressing the fundamental issue that we are actually not at war, since Section 2 of the Constitution has not been invoked by congressional approval. Therefore, the two professors, to paraphrase slightly, agree that fundamentally we are in a constitutional crisis, which seems to me to be of rather more importance than being attacked by particular groups in particular countries at particular times.
Constitutional crisis
like
that has existed.
Why the press seems to have uniformly glossed over this point.
Well, Stephen Carter.
Well, I don't know if the press has glossed over it or not. I've taught constitutional law and the war power in particular for almost 30 years now, and I'm well aware of the theory that's out there that the U.S. can't legally fight without a declaration of war. I just don't think it's true. That is, the Declaration of War Clause, what we know about its history, was included in the Constitution in keeping with the international laws understood at the time. It was a way of giving warning to third parties. You might be stopping the ships on the high seas or something like that. But there's only been one declaration of war in the world since 1948. No one declares war anymore. That's not how conflicts come about. And of the roughly 200 armed conflicts the United States has been involved in, and the dozen or so major ones, only about four have involved full declarations of war. I think Congress has gone along de facto by providing funds and so on. And I think if there is a crisis, the real crisis isn't so much whether Congress has declared war or not. Here, I think the caller is right. The crisis is that Congress tends to roll over when presidents say national security.
Yeah.
That is, as soon as the president says we're going to, and any president, Democratic or Republican, says we're going to be attacked or we've been attacked or we need this or that for our security, the floodgates of money open and Congress funds pretty much whatever the president asks for. Yeah. Later on, there's often regret and there's congressional investigations and so on. But I'd like to see those investigations and those regrets before we provide the money.
Giles, you were going to say?
The law professor at Harvard, who I have to admit his name I do not remember, when asked about a lawsuit by a citizen challenging the engagement of troops in these kinds of conflicts, said that members of Congress had, when Bush 1 occurred in Iraq, sought to go to court, and the courts refused to accept the suit, saying this was a disagreement between the Congress and the executive branch that would have to be handled between those two groups, that there was no legal recourse. So I'm afraid I would suggest that the issue of how many wars have been declared and how many have not may well be a moot point. And in any event, from my perspective, begs the fundamental question of the constitutionality and whether what we are going to see is erosions in other areas as well.
I think that's a great question and a very important point. And we have seen a lot of erosions in that sense. We've seen an enormous growth since Lincoln, in presidential authority beyond anything the framers wanted. We saw the growth begin with Lincoln, and then we saw it explode after Roosevelt. It's not only a matter of presidential supremacy over the legislature, it's also a matter of the number of people who simply work in the White House. But that's a story for another day.
Let's see if we get another caller in. Let's go to Brian. Brian with us from Canton in Ohio.
Hey, how you doing?
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm going to be not taking this position, or no one's going to take my position, but I studied the early anti-Nicene church for a long time, the first 300 years, and it should be noted that it was clear to them that war was unacceptable in any matter, and that should be stated. But my point with the just war theories that we're talking about is there's two major problems with it. One is we never address the issues of where we are culpable, whether it's overthrowing Mossadegh in the 50s, which got us in trouble with Iran, or a number of dictators we've supported. We don't ever address that and stop doing that. The second issue is with the just war theory, we tend to take those theories and make it fit wherever we need to. That goes with Clinton and Kosovo or Iraq or whatever. We find a way to make the just war fit. And one writer, Burkott, put in there, instead of saying killing men, put in those just war theories, raping women, and see if it sounds right to you. It's just a different perspective on it of why we don't do that and how we kind of make our things fit our perspective ideas.
Philosophical opportunism, I think, is charge here.
Two very quick responses. On the history, which I do actually talk about a little bit in the book, it's true that the early church was pacifist, although there's some debate about exactly why it was. The just war theory arose precisely to help Christians figure out if there were occasions when they could, consistently with their faith, go off to fight for the emperor or not. But as to the last point, which I think is a really interesting one, it is true that the United States over the years has supported a lot of unsavory dictators and other characters, but I'm not sure which way that cuts. I'm struck by Christopher Hitchens' comment about the war in Iraq. Christopher Hitchens has made the point that if the United States is the one who supported Saddam Hussein all these years, why isn't it our job to get rid of him too? His view was that that's an argument in favor of going into a war, not against it. I'm not saying he's right. I'm saying these are the sorts of interesting conversations I think we ought to be having.
We're talking with Stephen Carter about his new book, The Violence of Peace, America's Wars in the Age of Obama. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And are we having these conversations? Are these thoughts about the proper conduct of war, about the morality of war, about the legality of war, are they being held? And you point out that it is likely, whether we want to think about it or not, that these situations are going to be coming up in the future.
Well, that's right. And we don't know what's going to challenge us next. We don't know if the next problem will be a major terrorist attack or some other kind of conflict. But one of the things about President Obama's Nobel address that really struck me was his concern about genocide. President Clinton, after leaving office, said that the worst mistake he made in office was not to intervene during the genocide in Rwanda, which left something between 800,000 to a million dead. And I think that Obama is plainly sensitive to that. But one of the downsides of these long, exhausting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is that it's not clear that the American people would have the stomach to go to war to protect some suffering people somewhere, even if the political will existed in our leadership.
And political will is another aspect of, that's part of your just war theory. Can we have success if it's going to be a long, grinding war? History suggests the American people do not support it after a certain period of time.
Now, that's true. It's interesting that Americans will support wars even with high casualties. This is what the data tell us, even as long as they think America is winning. But if they think America is losing, or they think that we're at a stalemate, the level of support for a war tends to drop. And I think part of what's causing it to drop in Afghanistan is precisely that sense that not only is it stalemated now, that it's been stalemated for some time. And I know that the administration has lately made progress, for example, retaking Kandahar. But if you look over the years we've been in Afghanistan, the number of times we've retaken Kandahar, it boggles the mind. We're making the same progress over and over again, two steps forward and one step back.
There is also the conduct of the conflict, and you argue the media and our political leaders tend to do a very poor job of informing us what war is really like.
I think that's right, and I think we need to do a better job of thinking about what war is like before a war happens. And so, for example, when American forces commit atrocities, as at Abu Ghraib, the news media quite rightly bring them to our attention so we can condemn them. But that happens in every war. There's never been a war. You pick the best war you like, the Civil War, World War II, and although overwhelmingly American troops behave with enormous decorum under enormous pressure, there are always some people who do terrible things. It happens in every war. One of the ways I think the news media can help educate us is before we go to war, when we're debating whether to launch an invasion or launch a defense somewhere, to, at that point in advance, say to us, you know, if you go to war, there are terrible atrocities that will be committed, including some by your side. You have to accept that cost now as opposed to acting surprised by it later. That's one of the ways I think we can have more reflective conversations than we do.
Some of those conversations are conducted in Stephen Carter's new book, The Violence of Peace, America's Wars in the Age of Obama. The author, Yale University law professor, and of course novelist as well, joined us from a studio on the campus at Yale in New Haven. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Coming up next, Bill Carter for the New York Times on Keith Olbermann's surprise announcement to leave MSNBC. Did he push? Was he pushed? Did he jump? Stay tuned. I'm Neil Cunningham. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.